The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Mackenzie Jean Philippe is titled, What is Juneteenth? Why the Historic Day Should Be a Federal Holiday? Many of us in the United States have grown up with the idea that the 4th of July is just about as American as you can get. Cookouts, prideful tunes, fireworks, and that red, white, and blue flag help get us through a patriotic and federally recognized day of the year. But there's another event that deserves our attention and federal recognition. June 19, 1865, the day all people living in the United States, including the formerly enslaved, were officially granted freedom. You see, when it comes to July 4th, there's one hard fact to face. The beloved Star-Spangled Holiday marks the 1776 signing of the Declaration of Independence, which was written by Founding Father Thomas Jefferson, who at the time owned 180 enslaved people, with one-third of the signees also being slaveholders. The famous document even initially had a passage within it that denounced slavery, but it was removed in part to please the South, which relied heavily on the slave trade. In summary, a holiday founded on the idea of freedom for all Americans was created by a group of men who either treated black people as property or were not yet brave enough to stand up to the atrocities of slavery. And as former First Lady Michelle Obama reminded us in her powerful 2016 DNC speech, the White House was indeed built by the enslaved, underscoring the racism that went into founding our nation. Below we explain why Juneteenth was founded, how you can recognize it, and why it should be a federally recognized holiday just like the 4th of July. What exactly is Juneteenth? First, a little history. Going into the third year of the Civil War, on January 1, 1863, President Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation that declared all enslaved people in the rebellious Confederate states, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Louisiana, Mississippi, South Carolina, Texas, Arkansas, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Virginia, were free. But this executive order did not fully abolish slavery in the U.S., as it didn't apply to those held as property in bordering states who were loyal to the Union. The inaugural day we now know as Juneteenth occurred on June 19, 1865, when Lincoln's proclamation was finally enforced in Galveston, Texas, 2.5 years later. The state was known to many in the Confederate as a safe space for slaveholders, as it remained largely unoccupied by Union soldiers during the war. PBS reported that after the Emancipation Proclamation, many rebels from neighboring states fled to Texas and brought their illegal enslaved people with them. But on June 19th, Major General Gordon Granger issued an official order in Galveston informing black people that they were free. This is why we celebrate Juneteenth, because it honors the day in history all black people in America were both aware of the Emancipation Proclamation and officially legally released from their bonds. Later that year, in December 1865, slavery was formally abolished across the country with the ratification of the 13th Amendment. It read, "Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States or any place subject to their jurisdiction." Why is it called Juneteenth? The holiday, also known as Emancipation Day, occurs on June 19, so Juneteenth is a combination of the words June and 19th. Is it a federally recognized holiday? The short answer is no. But if we consider recent events, Juneteenth could well be on its way to becoming one. So far, Washington, D.C. and 46 states, not including North Dakota, South Dakota, Hawaii, and Montana, have passed legislation to recognize Juneteenth, though it's still not a paid holiday where all workers are given the day off, like July 4th. However, Texas led the charge in January 1980 when they named Juneteenth a formal state holiday. And most recently, in the wake of global fights for recognition and equality with the Black Lives Matter movement, in June 2020, both Virginia, with the help of Pharrell, and New York declared Emancipation Day an observed state-paid holiday. But that still leaves 47 more states to catch up. Corporations like Target, Nike, Twitter, the NFL, and even Hearst Magazines, which publishes O, the Oprah magazine, have also declared June 19th a company holiday. And each year, Texas Representative Sheila Jackson Lee introduces a resolution for Juneteenth to be recognized as a federal holiday, with this year's efforts gaining 200 co-sponsors, according to Time. Lee told the publication, "Juneteenth legislation is a call for freedom, but it also reinforces the history of African Americans. We've fought for this country. We've made great strides, but we're still the victims of sharp disparities. Our neighborhoods reflect that. Because of that, I think this is a time that we may find people who are desirous to understand the history, not necessarily only of African Americans, but the history of America. If you'd like to help push forward the call for Juneteenth to be made a federal holiday, there is a change.org petition that you can sign." Are there Juneteenth colors or a flag? The National Juneteenth Observance Foundation, founded in 1994, recognizes the same colors found in the U.S. flag, red, white, and blue, showing that the formerly enslaved were and are Americans. They also created an official flag for the holiday in 1997, which features red and blue striped sections separated by an arc that signifies new horizons and opportunity. In the middle is a large white star of Texas bursting with new freedom throughout the land, according to the National Juneteenth Observance Foundation site. The prominent star both represents Texas as the Lone Star State and symbolizes the freedom of all African Americans in the 50 states. In 2007, the significant date June 19, 1865 was added to the flag. But despite these being the formal colors of the holiday, you'll also see people honoring Black Independence Day with red, black, and green. These are the colors of the Pan-African flag, which was created in 1920 and encouraged by leader of the Universal Negro Improvement Association and Jamaican activist Marcus Garvey. This flag honors people of African diaspora and also symbolizes Black liberation and freedom. How can you celebrate or recognize Juneteenth? Juneteenth is celebrated across the country amongst Black families and friends with street fairs, parades, and concerts. The most jubilant annual celebrations take place in its Texas birthplace. Because of the holiday's Southern roots, barbecue is a must, and red foods like strawberry soda and red velvet cake are traditionally served as the color is a symbol of ingenuity and resilience in bondage, according to the New York Times. NJOF President Steve Williams also encouraged readings of the Emancipation Proclamation in USA Today. And for anyone who isn't Black but would like to recognize Juneteenth, June 19th is a great day to honor and embrace Black culture through its art and history. You might want to take the opportunity to learn about major firsts from African Americans, read a book, catch a film that honors Black life, or support Black-owned companies. But most importantly, remember that all of those things shouldn't just happen on Juneteenth, but every day, because it's never a bad time to celebrate the independence of everyone in our country. Our next article by Hamilton Kane is titled "Walter Isaacson's Latest Biography, The Codebreaker, is an Ode to Female Ingenuity in Science." When I was a child in the 70s, there were few bookstores in my Tennessee hometown, so I relied on weekly visits to three libraries, my cards crimped and yellowed like scraps of medieval parchment. I recall one dense, challenging read, Madame Curie, Eve Curie's biography of her mother, the first woman to win the Nobel Prize in chemistry. Marie Sklodowska's Polish girlhood, her marriage of minds with Pierre Curie in Paris, sudden widowhood, 2 Nobel Prizes, death caused by exposure to radium, an element she discovered. The arc of her life stirred my curiosity. She towered over unprecedented breakthroughs that continue to shape science a century later. Walter Isaacson's The Codebreaker by Simon & Schuster showcases another Nobel Prize winner, Jennifer Doudna, Ph.D., whose pioneering work echoes Curie's. CRISPR, spelled C-R-I-S-P-R, technology, an RNA-based form of gene editing, will enrich us for decades to come. Isaacson, the doyen of American journalism and a Renaissance-style artist in his own right, pivots off acclaimed biographies of Albert Einstein, Leonardo da Vinci, and Steve Jobs to portray the first woman in his gallery of big ideas. There are three great revolutions of our lifetimes: physics, digital, and now the life sciences, he says, explaining his shift to Doudna as subject. The Codebreaker is panoramic in scope and yet a page-turner, reminiscent of The Hot Zone and Hidden Valley Road. Like Curie before her, Doudna has carved her own path. The daughter of a literature professor, she grew up in Hilo, Hawaii, where she roamed the Big Island's volcanic slopes and lush hollows, wondering why Hahelia grass would curl when she touched it. In her sixth grade year, her father gave her a copy of The Double Helix, James Watson's chronicle of the race to discover the structure of DNA. Watson presents his and his colleague Francis Crick's accomplishment at the expense of another researcher, Rosalind Franklin, who haunts the backstage of The Codebreaker. Although Doudna was told that girls don't do science, Isaacson notes, nevertheless, she persisted. As an undergraduate at Pomona College, Doudna immersed herself in biochemistry and then opted for Harvard for her doctorate. These were heady times for DNA, the information molecule. An international consortium known as the Human Genome Project was ramping up, committed to mapping the human genetic code, all those spirals of A's, T's, G's, and C's, and initially helmed by Watson himself. The HGP was predicted to take 20 years, but wrapped up in a decade. Doudna, though, chose to study DNA's sister molecule, RNA, which was thought to be merely a messenger from DNA to cells in the human body, urging them to produce the enzymes and proteins necessary for life. She married Jamie Cate, another geneticist, moved her lab to the University of California in Berkeley, and gave birth to a son, all while wrestling with scientific puzzles off the well-traveled highway of the Human Genome Project. As Doudna realized, nobody puts RNA in the corner. The Codebreaker unfolds as an enthralling detective story, crackling with ambition and feuds, laboratories and conferences, Nobel laureates and self-taught mavericks. The book probes our common humanity without ever dumbing down the science, a testament to Isaacson's own genius on the page. He keeps the chapters short with subheads. The book moves at a clip as Doudna is drawn into the methods of CRISPR, in which RNA cuts and slices faulty DNA, much the way an editor would delicately tighten a manuscript with her pencil. After a chance meeting with French CRISPR expert Emmanuel Charpentier at a conference in Puerto Rico, Doudna vowed to bear down on the technology. The therapeutic and entrepreneurial possibilities seemed endless. But there was a complication. Other scientists were in the hunt, notably Feng Zhang of the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard. Founded in 2004 by Eric Lander, Ph.D., a charismatic visionary and a chief architect of the Human Genome Project, the Broad is a gleaming warren of laboratories in Cambridge, Massachusetts, sporting a blue-chip roster of researchers and clinicians. Lander is currently on a leave of absence from the Broad, awaiting confirmation as President Biden's director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy, the first cabinet post for a scientist in U.S. history. Zhang was Lander's protege. While Doudna's lab pushed hard to show that CRISPR could work in a test tube, Zhang's used CRISPR to edit actual human cells. A bi-coastal war erupted, with patents on the line, court cases on the docket, and massive egos ready to rumble. Doudna and another grandee, George Church, in one corner, with Lander and Zhang in another. The choreography of these scientists was occasionally disrupted by a few bad boys and girls, a generation thumbing their noses at Marquess of Queensberry rules. Isaacson revels in the story of Josiah Zahner, known for cooking up experiments in his garage and then injecting CRISPR into his body. Zahner, with his bleached blonde forelock and 10 piercings in each ear, thus became the poster boy for a new kind of biohacker. The spirited band of renegades and merry hobbyists who want to democratize biology through citizen science and bring its power to the people, Isaacson writes. In the drama of CRISPR, Zahner plays the role of one of Shakespeare's wise fools, such as Puck in A Midsummer Night's Dream, who pokes fun at the pretensions of the high-minded and pushes us forward by pointing out what fools these mortals be. Isaacson also deftly delves into perhaps the most provocative issue surrounding CRISPR, designer babies. In the future, CRISPR will benefit couples with known genetic diseases scattered throughout their families, such as Huntington's, cystic fibrosis, or Tay-Sachs. This is familiar terrain to me. In 2004, shortly after our oldest son's diagnosis of spinal muscular atrophy, or SMA type 1, a devastating neuromuscular disorder, my wife and I, unnerved by the 1 in 4 chance another child would be similarly affected, opted for a procedure called preimplantation genetics diagnosis, or PGD. After a cycle of IVF, clinicians biopsied a single cell from each of our fertilized embryos, flew those cells in an icebox to a Michigan lab for analysis, and by phone the next day verified which embryos were affected. Our healthy 15-year-old twins are the fruits of these labors. Isaacson lays out the basics of PGD with care, but then goes a step further. Unlike 16 years ago, when my wife and I depended on yay or nay for each embryo with a 98% accuracy rate, CRISPR could swap out the defective gene for a healthy one. Doudna recognized the upside in eliminating physical and emotional agony for families, and CRISPR will likely help to cure SMA and other single-gene diseases. But she was nervous about unlocking a Gattaca-like future in which parents could shop a la carte for their children's traits. Wavy blonde hair, steely blue eyes, sculpted washboard abs. And with price tags that only the affluent could afford, CRISPR could widen chasms of inequality. As Isaacson opines, the danger of genetic technology might not be too much government control. Instead, it may be too much individual control, one based on free choice and marketed consumerism. Enter Hei Jingkui, the poor boy makes good Chinese CRISPR expert, who successfully edited out a gene associated with HIV, allowing an HIV-infected husband and non-infected wife to give birth to twin daughters in 2018, stunning the world. For the first time, a species had deliberately altered its own code of life. The publicity was explosive, the blowback fierce, with Doudna at the center of the storm, compelled to craft ethical guidelines that somehow avoided a moratorium on the use of CRISPR in humans. Isaacson untangles the Gordian knot of technological achievements, moral concerns, and cultural differences. CRISPR's most immediate legacy may well be our current plague. As cities and nations went into lockdown a year ago, Doudna and her team went into overdrive, devising a diagnostic COVID-19 test. Her lab reached out to others, including Feng Zhang's, sharing data in a spirit of collaboration. You can draw a straight line from CRISPR's RNA underpinnings to the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. For Isaacson, our moment is a window into the near future, when CRISPR home testing kits are as simple to use as a pregnancy test you'd pick up at a drugstore. Virology will come into our homes as personal computers did a generation ago, transforming medicine and health and our personal relationships to biotechnology. You'll be able to determine whether your kid's sore throat is caused by strep or a coronavirus. Doudna's sweeping research and applications of CRISPR were exalted when she and Emmanuel Charpentier won the 2020 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. The journey that commenced in Hawaii culminated at Science's Everest. And as the pandemic rages on, a thrilling cadre of women have come to the fore. Epidemiologists, physicians, and journalists who have amplified and interpreted data, lending clarity to confusion. Sarah Gilbert, Helen Bronswell, Elaine Chu, Uzme Blackstock, Natalie Dean, Apoorva Mandavilli, Zeynep Tufekci, and Emma Hodcroft. Know their names. Follow them on Twitter. Keep up as they lead us forward. As with Jennifer Doudna, they persist. Our next article by Samantha Vicente is titled, Why Gender Reveal Parties Should Have Been Canceled Long Before the California Fires. The family who announced the sex of their baby with an explosion of color at Yucaipa, California's El Dorado Ranch Park didn't mean to start the fire that's since driven 21,000 people from their homes. They tried to put it out with water bottles, fire investigators told CNN, but 3 days later, the growing blaze was only 16% contained. There's no time to consider why on earth anyone would intentionally cause a spark outdoors during what was already predicted to be a rough California wildfire season, because so many other questions that preceded this tragedy remain. Why do people insist on gender reveal stunts, and why is there a fixation on gender reveals in general? Even the woman credited with popularizing the trend has said time and again that she deeply regrets it. With so many things to celebrate about an impending bundle of joy, it's long past time to shelve the gender reveal party trend. They're problematic for many reasons, including the preventable disasters that are making headlines right now. Here's what you should know. The El Dorado fire is not the first to be caused by a gender reveal stunt. In 2017, an Arizona off-duty U.S. Customs and Border Patrol protection agent named Dennis Dickey fired a gun into a target packed with an explosive material called tannerite. The resulting fire spread into the Coronado National Forest and a mix of state, federal, and private land, burning up nearly 47,000 acres and causing $8 million in property damage, to say nothing of the environmental consequences. Dickey ultimately agreed to 5 years probation, plus paying $200,000 in damages. It is not yet clear whether the family that started the El Dorado fire will be held responsible in any way, but these aren't the only two gender reveals that led to fire. In April 2020, another tannerite target demolished 10 acres of Florida forest before it was contained. Another reveal killed a grandmother at a family party. More calls to reconsider this trend came after an October 2019 disaster, when excited grandmother-to-be Pamela Kramer was killed by shrapnel lodged in her head. Her Iowa family accidentally created a pipe bomb with their homemade gunpowder-filled contraption, which was meant to discharge Instagrammable streaks of colored powder, but instead sent metal chunks flying. Kramer died instantly on the scene. The woman who popularized the gender reveal party trend now calls them a nightmare. Blogger Jenna Kervendice shared her creative celebration of Bianca, her baby-to-be, in 2008, throwing a party in which she cut open a cake to reveal its pink insides. The viral blog post set a trend that continues today, but she really wishes that wasn't the case. Not just because the stunts have gotten so out of hand, but because of the potentially toxic subtext to a party that hinges on the idea that a person's gender defines them before they've even entered the world. This crystallized for Jenna when her now 11-year-old made her realize that firsthand. Plot twist, Jenna wrote on Facebook in 2019, the world's first gender reveal party baby is a girl who wears suits. The problem is they overemphasize one aspect of a person. Kervendice, who says she never had another gender reveal for her two kids after Bianca, elaborated in a recent essay for The Guardian. She went on to explain how another daughter of hers helped teach her that lesson. On Christmas morning, when she was 3, she opened up a set of Legos in primary colors and started crying. She said, Santa Claus brought me a boy toy. She thought because they weren't pink, they weren't for her, Kervendice wrote. That's when I was like, you know what, something has to change. There's such an obsession with gender that it becomes limiting in many ways. You don't want what's between your legs to guide your path in life. I want my kids to grow up in a world where gender doesn't matter. News of the El Dorado wildfire have since made Corvindis a bit more blunt. Stop it. Stop having these stupid parties. For the love of God, stop burning things down to tell everyone about your kid's penis. No one cares but you. Social media has upped the gender reveal ante to an unnecessary degree. Gone are the days when a mere cake with pink insides would garner enough likes to create an online sensation. Now people arrange for planes to dump a wash of revelatory color, one crashed in Texas in 2019, or in a viral video that brought mixed reactions, placed a watermelon filled with dye into the mouth of a hippopotamus. At least the hippo's okay. Yes, it's about celebrating exciting news with loved ones, but would they be so elaborate if they weren't made to be shared online? There's this huge pressure to publicize these once private moments, Carly Giesler, an associate professor at the City University of New York's York College, who studied the phenomenon, told USA Today in 2019. You get that outside validation that what you did was unique, that it was extra special. It drives celebrations to the extreme because you're trying to do the thing that no one's done before. Gender-related anxiety contributes to death and violence against transgender and non-binary people. A person or couple who's been trying for a baby of a certain sex for years is completely allowed to be excited about their news, and wanting to celebrate that major event is understandable. But let's say that baby who was born a girl grows up to realize that they identify as transgender. Will they be embraced or punished and shunned by their family for not fulfilling the expectations established with that first plume of pink smoke? Fun fact, the pink and blue colors assigned to gender were wholly a creation of American retail manufacturers from the 1940s onward. Like many gender conventions, the shades were completely made up and then rarely questioned. According to a Human Rights Campaign Foundation report, anti-transgender stigma, denial of opportunity, and increased risk factors compound to create a culture of violence. What begins with a lack of family acceptance can result in sexual assault, homelessness, or even murder. In fact, at least 21 trans or gender nonconforming people have been killed in the first 7 months of 2020, in part due to transphobia, the most since the HRC began tracking it in 2013. Gender reveal parties are obviously not the direct cause of a spike in trans violence. But before you light that blue powder-filled cannon, it's good to know how you'd react if your child one day told you they are not, in fact, a boy. The mom who's worried about the pink triangles on her baby's son's crib sheet is a very far cry from the person who kills another human over their perceived gender transgressions, but they do share one thing, a strong belief that gender comes with rules to be followed. There are so many other things to celebrate about a baby. Some expectant parents may feel that a baby shower simply isn't enough revelry, particularly if they've been previously grappling with infertility or the pregnancy was preceded by miscarriage. Absolutely no one is saying that you can't have 10 more parties for your fetus that have nothing to do with its genitals. You might have a partied-out cousin or two who'd beg to differ, but that's between you guys. You can throw an announcement party, a baby naming party, a let's get together and finger paint funny faces on your bump party. The sky's the limit, and you're free to get as creative as you'd like. Plus, when you don't care what your baby's gender is, as my partner and myself didn't when I was pregnant, it actually feels deeply weird when so many people around you suddenly need to know your baby's sex. As my belly grew, the deluge of obsessed comments did too, until all of the questions and declarations like, what's the gender, and you didn't find out, I go crazy, and how will you plan the nursery if you don't know, begin to sound sweaty and creepy. Eventually, does it have a penis or vagina down there? Tell me, I've got to know, is all we heard whenever family members and various strangers leaned in and started up with their fixation on a topic we were not remotely interested in. So I made up my own answer to the unending, do you know what you're having? A healthy human baby, I'd say, because that's what we all want most in the end. In our next article by Ariana Davis, it's titled, Robin Crawford Opens Up to Lena Waithe About Her Relationship with Whitney Houston. It's been nearly four decades since Robin Crawford played college basketball, But when she arrives to the O offices in New York City one chilly fall morning, she walks with the swagger of an athlete. Her face lights up whenever her wife Lisa looks her way, but otherwise she wears a serious expression. Her voice is soft, her energy calm. Crawford grew up in East Orange, New Jersey, one of three siblings, the daughter of a single mother who left her husband after years of abuse. In 1980, she was 19, home from college for the summer, and working at a community center camp when she met a 17-year-old counselor named Whitney, known by her childhood nickname Nippy or Nip back then. Their friendship was fast, fueled by cocaine and an 80s soundtrack of songs by Chaka Khan and Donny Hathaway. But their bond also quickly turned intimate, an intense relationship that lasted for 2 years before Houston put an end to it just before signing her deal with Arista Records. Each half of the pair wrote their vow to stop being physical in the pages of a blue Bible Houston gave to Crawford. Their promise was to remain friends no matter what, with a focus on the bigger picture, the career of Whitney Houston. And for 20 years, Crawford remained dedicated to that mission, first as Houston's assistant and later creative director. The release of A Song for You, My Life with Whitney Houston, comes a few years after two buzzy documentaries. First, 2017's Can I Be Me, which featured never-before-seen archival footage from Houston's world tour in 1999. And then there was 2018's Whitney, which depicted Houston's rise and later downfall at the hands of substance abuse, with interviews from her family and friends. In both films, members of Houston's camp spoke about the speculation surrounding Crawford and Houston, confirming the rumors that their friendship wasn't strictly platonic, and even hinting at a rift between Crawford and Houston's husband, singer Bobby Brown, because of it. After more than 30 years out of the public eye, Crawford, now 56, married to Lisa and living in New Jersey with 10-year-old twins, is surprisingly revealing in her book, A Song for You, My Life with Whitney Houston. From the first time a teenage Houston offered Crawford a joint, to the day Crawford quit Houston's team after a Bobby Brown tantrum, the author writes sentimentally, but also candidly. And between the juicy moments the internet will latch onto, after all, with a front row seat to her best friend's life and career, Crawford saw everything, there is a coming-of-age story. A Song for You may be set to the life of Whitney Houston, but this is Crawford's tale, one of a woman who lost her family to AIDS, struggled with substance abuse while watching her best friend spiral, and grew up sexually fluid long before society came to embrace open conversations about queerness. When Lena Waithe shows up to interview Crawford, she's accompanied by an assistant and her creative partner, Rishi Rahani. It's a much smaller crew and ego than might be expected from the screenwriter and actress who's been a media darling since she became the first Black woman to win an Emmy Award for outstanding writing for a comedy series for her episode of Master of None in 2017. Since, Waithe has created the acclaimed Showtime series The Chi and Queen and Slim, the powerful and timely romance film she penned that's already garnering Oscar buzz. Waithe arrives an hour early for this interview. A lifelong diehard Whitney Houston fan, she devoured A Song for You in 3 days and is eager to let Crawford know the impact she's had on her. "I don't exist in this world without you being as authentic as you were," Waithe tells her when they first meet. "Because yes, I grew up watching Whitney Houston on TV, but I would always zero in on you. You've got to be special for somebody to look past Whitney Houston and go, who's that?" Waithe adds that even before she had fully realized her own queer identity, she connected to Crawford. "I saw myself in you, and I didn't know why back then. I was a young person who didn't have the language to understand who I was yet, but I was aware I wasn't like everybody else. That I knew." And then, as a moody gray sky rains down outside the window beside them, Robin Crawford tells Lena Waithe her story, her way. "Whitney Houston is as American as apple pie. She is Americana to me. She's an icon. What was it like having a front row seat to that journey? How did you have the emotional intelligence to share your best friend with the entire world while also being her assistant?" I knew early on what role I was playing in Whitney Houston's life. She made that very clear. The machine, and when I say the machine, I mean the record company. Back then, it was much bigger, and it was mostly men controlling pretty much all of it. So as soon as she signed a record deal, things suddenly became much more complicated, and she knew that she couldn't be two places at the same time. And as her best friend, I knew her better than anyone else. So my role was, I've got to protect her and let her know what's happening. I would go to the next spot on her itinerary 15 minutes ahead of time to get a vibe for the energy in the room so that when she got there, I could tell her what to expect. We were a team. We always knew she had a bigger purpose, and we were ready for this. We were fearless, ferocious, intelligent, beautiful, strong, and determined. She had me, I had her. And our eyes never left each other, but I knew my role. I was the number two. A lot of us have been wanting to hear from you for a long time, but many people's questions will be, why now? I'm personally happy that you got the chance to speak your piece because there's been so much said about you and Whitney over the years. You come up in her mother Sissy Houston's book, in Bobby Brown's book. Bobby even said something like, if Robin had stuck around, Whitney would still be alive, which was a very heavy statement. After all these years, what made you say, it's time? I had comfort in my silence for many years. When her daughter, Bobby Christina, passed away in 2015, that's when I first really felt the need to stand up, hearing the way people were treating Bobby, Whitney, our friendship, and their version of my story. And I felt the legacy of my friend was buried underneath all of that. That's when I had to ask Nip about writing this book. I actually sat there and asked her up above, what would you want me to do? Do you understand why now? Feeling her yes, that was my clearance. When I felt complete in my being that I could have the confidence to stand up and lift her legacy out of the trash, to elevate it and put it back in her hands, while also honoring our friendship, that's when I felt ready. I will say, and I mean this as a compliment, I think you're very polite in the way you talk about certain things that happened. Yeah, I'm not trying to get back at people. You write about the two of you meeting as camp counselors as teens. I loved how almost immediately you're like, look, man, she wasn't no angel. You describe her pulling a joint out of her bra. But then there's a juxtaposition where she's like, yo, come hear me sing at church. She was a bad girl. Nip would get you in trouble. So here's the thing. I think people all have the same question. Were y'all together or not? What I love as a queer person myself is that when you're describing when you were first intimate as teenagers, it felt no different than, I think, most young women's stories. I think what you describe is so innocent. We were exploring each other. But then you decide to end your physical relationship, and not long after that you move in together. And if I can keep it 100, as I read that, I said, this feels like a disaster waiting to happen. But why? Because, yo, look, even though you guys had a conversation about ending it, you're a human being. You can't shut off feelings that quickly. You write about living together and watching her secretly dating Jermaine Jackson, who was married at the time. How could you deal with all of that, given your history? Well, we had one vision, and that was to make her dream happen. I left school not to be her lover, but to be there for her, to work and watch her rise. I believed in the dream that she painted. When I saw her in church, I felt the energy. I was a witness. I knew she had a powerful gift to touch people that was much bigger than either of us. So as far as getting our own place, believe me, if you were back there with me at that time, it only seemed natural. I was just trying to grow up and get out of my parents' house at the same time we were trying to get a rhythm and get her dream going. And above all else, we were friends. Yes, we ate up that first summer together, talking about everything, talking about music, spending time together, misbehaving together. You name it, we did it. We were intimate with all of it. And the physical part was like a river. We both dived in, and there was goodness there. But the big picture was always where she was going, and our friendship was the foundation. My other question is, and we're jumping ahead in time a little bit, but I can't imagine being in your shoes as maid of honor on her wedding day to Bobby Brown. By then, we were so past that, but I will say I did feel that I was losing her in some way, because back then it was very much when a woman gets married, you lose them, because they are committed to their marriage entirely. So I did feel that, looking at her on her wedding day, bonding her life with someone else. I did see that in her eyes, that I was losing her. Were you skeptical about her marriage to Bobby? Not at all. I really wanted this to work for my friend. I wanted whatever vision she dreamed for herself. I wanted her to be happy. Look, I heard the rumors about Bobby just like she did. I didn't know anything else about him beyond what everyone else knew. That he was a womanizer, that he was over here with this one, that one. But he was obsessed with Whitney. Later on, though, I realized that Bobby never knew Nip. He never got to be her friend. But as far as watching her date other people, when I found out she was dating Jermaine Jackson, I was more disappointed that she felt she couldn't talk to me like a girlfriend. I mean, he's a Jackson. We grew up loving the Jacksons. If we were friends, why shouldn't we be able to talk about that? I write about that night when I confronted her about what was going on between them, how I could feel that there was something between them. So if you want to talk about the physical part between Whitney and I, yes, I could feel that she was being physical with other people, starting with Jermaine. I didn't need her to tell me. And I cried. I understand that it was a different time, and back then there was maybe no way for you guys to have a conversation about your intimate relationship, because it seems like you both felt there was no way for it to evolve. But at that point in your relationship, was she able to say, "Are you okay with this? Is this weird for you?" No, it wasn't, "Are you okay with this?" I had to be okay with it, because we had already said what was best for us, what was best for the journey. But emotions are emotions. Emotions are emotions, which is why she just stood there and let me let out my anger by tearing that room up. And then she said, "Okay, now clean it up." When you mentioned she was dating Eddie Murphy and Bobby at the same time, yet Eddie wasn't giving her the time of day, I was really shocked about that, especially the fact that Eddie called Whitney on her wedding day to tell her not to marry Bobby. That was nuts. On her wedding day, Whitney is telling me about his call, and I'm in and out of the room as the maid of honor as she's getting ready, and I'm just listening. I didn't really know the ins and outs of what was going on with her and Eddie. All I saw was my friend chasing a guy who did not deserve her. I don't think Eddie will ever speak publicly about them dating, even though there were obviously pictures of them together. He called them friends, but he didn't show me someone that was a thoughtful friend. But she spent a lot of time with Eddie. I remember she had a few of his shirts. She loved him. Whitney liked dark-skinned guys. She had a type. Like, she would have never dated a white man. And you know what? Whitney told her personal assistant Sylvia and I that she wasn't going to get serious with Bobby. Whatever went on, she showed signs that her heart was really with Eddie. So when you found out she was marrying Bobby, how was that for you? Were you like, "Okay, how's this going to affect us? Do I got to deal with this dude?" I remember in the documentary, Can I Be Me, there's footage of him trying to pal around with you, and you seem a little annoyed with him. Oh, I was annoyed with him on that tour because he was annoying, but we were cool. There were no Everlast shorts and boxing gloves and all that stuff people like to say about me and Bobby. He never raised his hand to me. Now, I never had a real substantial conversation with him either, the kind where you connect with someone, sit down and talk to them. I would just see Bobby perform. That's what I'd call it. I'd see him behave in a way that maybe it was jealousy, or you might mistake that for him being protective of Whitney. But I didn't have this conversation with Whitney about it. And I write in the book, I'd buy gifts for someone from Whitney, and Bobby would flip. When I mean flip, that's when he'd get in my face, and Whitney wouldn't say anything. And that's what happened when you eventually left Whitney's team. You bought a shirt for George Michael on behalf of Whitney, and Bobby was upset, and Whitney didn't do anything, and that was the last straw? Yeah, that was cumulative. I had been dealing with a lot of things with him over the years, him answering her phone and hanging it up, a lot of jealousy, and it wasn't necessary. One of my favorite Whitney interviews is the last one she did with Oprah, which was eye-opening for a lot of people. We knew her marriage with Bobby wasn't easy, but she revealed a lot of dark things in that interview about him spitting at her, ripping her face off a family portrait. I'm assuming you weren't shocked by any of that. I never saw Bobby spit on her. I never saw him physically hit her. But I would get the calls from Sylvia, who was there all the time, and I'm talking in the wee hours of the morning. So I wasn't surprised when I heard Whitney say those things to Oprah, and I'm sure she left a whole lot out. In the book, you reference going to visit her cousin, Dee Dee Warwick, when you two were teens. But as you know, in the second documentary, Whitney, there are allegations that Whitney was abused by a family member, and that family member was Dee Dee. But it's not something you bring up in the book. Is that because you felt those allegations weren't accurate? Whitney was very close to the Warwicks before superstardom and during. She talked a lot about Dee Dee, how talented she was as a singer, how funny. And Whitney and I talked a lot about our families. She told me everything. So if there was any truth to that, I would have known. I don't have any doubt about that. It's tricky because they say she was touched by a woman, and then it's insinuated, oh, maybe that's why she was so confused about her sexuality. The whole thing is a little murky, and it could also be a little bit dangerous, in my opinion. Because then it's like, maybe that's what drew Whitney to you, so to speak. Is that what people are implying? The Whitney I knew never talked labels. Never. Understandably, in your book, you say you found it hurtful the way she responded when she was asked about her sexuality. I've seen interviews where she would respond with things like, Whitney's only gay when she's happy, honey. I didn't like some of the things she said. I didn't feel like it was helping things. But she didn't care at that point. She would say, they'll say what they want to say. As for me, I don't label myself today. I don't feel like I have to slap a label on my chest just because I found love with my wife. Just because I choose to stand up for anything that I choose to support doesn't mean that I have to be this or that. I'm just Robin. And Whitney, who also pushed back on labels. That went for her music, too. She didn't sing black music or white music. She just sang. It was very harrowing to read about when you left Whitney's team. It's a very dark portion of the book, but it's also my favorite part because you're rebuilding yourself. And that led to your lovely wife, Lisa. And I'm glad you dedicated the book to her because obviously the love you had with Whitney led you to your everlasting love with Lisa. Which is almost like, what greater gift can a friend give you than a life partner? I call that the third act of the book, about you leaving your friend. I have to say, I never saw me resigning as leaving my friend. I never felt that. Do you think she was a little hurt by you quitting, though? I think she felt just like I felt, that it was time. I didn't feel like I was being effective. I didn't have her ear anymore. We had been off track for a long time. She called me after I handed in my resignation, and she said we would talk more. But that talk never happened. You know, Whitney didn't like confrontation. I wanted to meet someplace away from distractions because there were always several people at that house. But there was no downtime at her and Bobby's house. No peace, no quiet. What was the last thing you did say to each other? The last time I spoke to her was probably the time she called me after she called 911 about an altercation with Bobby. She called me that night, and the very last thing we said to each other was what we always said to each other when we would hang up. I love you. Call me. And we never got to call each other again. But she's here. She's with me. I know she is. And she's never left. Our next article by Elena Nicolou is titled, How Princess Diana's Childhood Set Her Up for a Life as a Royal. Diana is often remembered for everything that happened after her meeting with Prince Charles. The whirlwind courtship, 13 whole dates, the show-stopping wedding, their dramatic divorce, and her death. What was her life like before she became one of England's, if not the world's, most beloved figures? Born to two wealthy parents on July 1, 1961, Lady Diana Spencer grew up adjacent to the aristocracy. Though she first met Prince Charles at the age of 16, she knew many people in his family. Queen Elizabeth II was her brother's godmother, and she played with Charles's brothers as a child. According to an anecdote from Tina Brown's The Diana Chronicles, Charles, then 17, once interrupted 5-year-old Diana's tea party with Andrew. The Spencers had been a prominent family since the 15th and 16th century, according to a book about the family's history. They made their initial fortune with sheep farming and never lost that said fortune. In 1975, Diana earned the title of Lady when her grandfather died and her father became the 8th Earl Spencer. The Spencer men have their earlship, but it's the Spencer women who have made headlines over the years. While Diana is the most famous of the Spencers, she's descended from other fascinating females. Sarah Marlborough was Queen Anne's controversial confidant and was played by Rachel Weisz in The Favourite. And Georgiana, Duchess of Devonshire, became a celebrity in Georgian-era England for her unusual marriage arrangement. She was portrayed by Keira Knightley in The Duchess. Clearly, Diana's childhood was one of privilege and esteem, but was it joyful? One of her nannies weighed in with her opinion. Diana had a happy, secure childhood. From the moment I met her and worked with the family, I saw she was helpful, laughing, exuberant, loved by both her parents and the apple of her father's eye, her former nanny Mary Clark wrote. However, Diana's brother, the current Earl Spencer, disagrees with that rosy picture. Here's what we know about the childhood of Princess Diana. Diana had 4 siblings, including a sister who dated Prince Charles. Diana's father, John Spencer, was the 8th Earl Spencer, though was a Viscount when he married. Her mother, Frances Ruth Roche, was the daughter of Maurice Roche, 4th Baron Fermoy, and Ruth Roche, Baroness Fermoy, and was even wealthier than the Spencers. Queen Elizabeth attended their wedding in 1954. Like Diana, Frances was a young bride. She was only 18 when she married John, who was 30. The Spencers had 5 children, including Diana. Their 3rd child and long-awaited son, John, died as an infant, devastating Diana's mother. Diana grew up with her 2 sisters, Lady Sarah and Lady Jane, and her brother, Charles. Before Diana became involved with Prince Charles, he dated her eldest sister, Sarah, in 1977. Her parents divorced when she was 7, and it changed Diana forever. In 1969, the family unit ruptured when Diana's mother reportedly abruptly left her father for Peter Shan Kidd, an Australian wallpaper tycoon. What ensued was a courtroom and custody battle and resulted in what her brother called an unhappy childhood. Diana and I had 2 older sisters who were away at school, so she and I were very much in it together, and I did talk to her about it, Spencer explained in a revealing 2020 interview in the Sunday Times. Our father was a quiet and constant source of love, but our mother wasn't cut out for maternity. Not her fault. She couldn't do it. She was in love with someone else. Infatuated, really. Following an intense custody battle, in which Frances's mother Ruth testified against her, the Spencer children lived with their father permanently. According to her brother, Diana felt abandoned by their mother. While she was packing her stuff to leave, she promised Diana she'd come back to see her. Diana used to wait on the doorstep for her, but she never came, Charles, Diana's brother, told the Sunday Times. However, the Diana Chronicles paints a more complicated picture. According to the book, Frances was shut out of the children's lives, with the doors of Park House literally closed on her. She never expected to lose her children and would cry at the end of every Saturday visit. "Oh, I don't want you to leave tomorrow," Diana recalled, per the book. Charles, who was 2 when their parents divorced, said Diana was like a mother figure to him. "She was the big sister who mothered me as a baby and endured those long train journeys between our parents' homes with me at weekends," he told the Sunday Times. Diana's mother and her husband eventually settled on a small Scottish island off the coast of Oban, where she opened a gift shop. Diana reportedly didn't get along well with her father's 2nd wife, socialite Rain Legg. Charles's 4 children were not informed of their wedding, nor were they invited to the party, according to the Diana Chronicles. As a girl, Diana played with her future brother-in-laws. Diana was born in Park House, a 9-bedroom mansion located on the Queen's grounds at Sandringham. The house was built in 1863 by the Prince of Wales, later King Edward VII, to accommodate overflow at his royal home. When Queen Elizabeth II and her family were staying at Sandringham, they socialized with the Spencers. In 1987, Park House was converted into a 3-star hotel designed for travelers with disabilities. According to a review, guests are shown the bedroom where Diana was born. She had other connections to the royal family, lots of them. Even before Diana married into the royal family, she knew them intimately. Diana's family had multiple connections to the crown. Her brother Charles is Queen Elizabeth II's godson. Her father, the 8th Earl Spencer, was Queen Mary's godson. And her grandmother, Lady Fermoy, was a lady-in-waiting to the Queen Mother. Diana wanted to become a dancer, above all. Diana had a number of passions outside of school. She was a swimmer, a skier, a tennis player, a pianist. Above all, though, she wanted to become a ballerina. However, at 5'10", she struggled to pursue the career. According to the book The Real Diana, at the age of 17, she reached out to the Vicani Dance School to train as a dancing teacher, even if she was unable to be a ballerina. Madame Vicani told the author of The Real Diana that she only trained for a month. She went skiing and never came back. I think that she felt that the training, 3 years and until 6:30 in the evening, would be too all-embracing. She never gave a reason for not returning, the book says. Simply put, becoming a dance teacher wasn't her passion. Dancing was. Whenever she was feeling stressed, Diana would dance. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.